Penguin Random House Audio presents Beneath a Ruthless Sun, a true story of violence, race, and justice lost and found by Gilbert King. Read for you by Kimberly Farr. To gain these fruits that have been earned, to hold these fields that have been won, our arms have strained. Our backs have burned, bent bare beneath a ruthless sun. James Weldon Johnson, 50 years, 1863 to 1913. Racism has never been a simple story, ever. Ta-Nehisi Coates on Twitter. Part 1. Chapter 1. A Killing Freeze. In Okahumka, he was known as the boy on the bike. Most any afternoon, as soon as he heard the Atlantic coastline train blow its whistle on its approach to the depot, a few miles south of Leesburg, he would be pedaling his way to pick up the afternoon post. At Fate Merritt's grocery, Mayo Carlton might grab hold of the store fiddle and play Mary Had a Little Lamb for him, while Postmaster Sally Reeves sorted the mail in the next room. Buster Beach would be there too, well before the West Coast champion arrived, to share the day's gossip or to tell the boy a corn-fed tale. The men of Okahumka spoke kindly to him. They'd offer him a wedge of tangerine and tousle his uncombed hair with their meaty, sun-baked hands. They were sure to ask about his daddy. Some days the boy would linger at the grocery, a nickel in his palm, his eyes on the penny treats, until Mr. Merritt would hand him his favorite black cow candy and patiently narrate the financial transaction. The boy would smile and say thank you, but the arithmetic lesson would be lost on him by the time he reached the door. Other boys and girls his age had finished high school, but Jesse Delbert Daniels had fallen behind early. It had taken him 4 years to pass the third grade, and by the age of 16 he had advanced only two more. He was not educable, the fifth-grade teacher at Leesburg Elementary School told his mother. And although he'd been granted a social promotion, it came with the condolatory recommendation that he be withdrawn from further schooling. The mail pocketed in his baggy trousers, and the trousers tucked into his socks so they'd not catch in the bike's greasy chain, the boy would pedal back toward home. The way took him by the fishing hole, where he often passed his days. Often Jesse would dawdle, mail in pocket, with no notice of the hours passing, until he found himself caught in a summer downpour. The torrential afternoon rain soaking his hair and clothes, he would stand up on the pedals and lean into the blustery wind, while the clay kicking up from the tires spattered his pants and shirt. His mother, Pearl, would rush him inside their humble wooden house, take the wet mail, and dry him briskly with a towel. She'd remind him to pedal home fast when the sky over Sumterville began to darken, and Jesse would say, "Sorry, Mama." But he'd be no more mindful the next time he saw cascades of black and gray clouds billowing in the west, and he'd hear no alarm in the volleys of distant thunder. Jesse's rides almost always took him past the 54-acre Knowles estate off Bug Spring Road. The imposing two-story Georgian frame house with two white columns on its front porch stood grandly among oaks and palm trees and a small grove of Florida pines that towered over the surrounding fields and scrub. Joe Knowles sometimes hired Jesse for seasonal work there. In summer, it was watermelons. The 50-pound Garrisons and Tom Watsons demanded more strength to pick, load, and pack without bruising than a scrawny boy could offer, however. While some Lake County farmers hired white football players from Leesburg High, who took the opportunity to bulk up their muscles pitching melons, Jesse usually worked with black laborers, trailing behind the cutters. Alongside pint-sized Negro boys, brush in one hand and in the other a jar of thick copper sulfate paste, he'd paint the freshly cut stems to reduce the threat of parasitic fungi. Or he'd glue labels on melons before they were stacked in the rail cars. When spring came around, Jesse got hired on to drop seeds for a new crop and to fertilize the young vines for 85 cents an hour. The money was needed. Jesse's father, Charles, was an illiterate 69-year-old veteran of World War I, with a long history of arthritis, as well as a debilitating heart condition that for the past decade had rendered him unemployable. His meager monthly welfare benefits and army pension could not keep pace with the family's rent increases, and almost yearly they'd had to relocate from Okahumpka to ever smaller houses in ever more remote corners of Lake County. Yalaha, Howie in the hills, until they'd settled once again in rural Okahumpka. Jesse's mother, Pearl, was 26 years younger than her husband, but likewise debilitated by a weak heart. She had had 4 miscarriages before Jesse was born in 1938 and would go on to suffer 2 more. During her pregnancy with Jesse, she'd been stricken with malaria, which devastated large swaths of the American South in the 1930s, as a growing number of poor people built shacks in swampland. Doctors had therefore advised Pearl to wean the newborn quickly, but Jesse's health was precarious too. In infancy, he contracted whooping cough, and in childhood, he suffered 3 bouts of rheumatic fever. The second attack, at age 10, left him slow to think, as Pearl put it, and the last, at 16, left him with a stammer and perhaps damage to his heart valves. In 1956, Pearl had applied to have Jesse admitted to the Florida Farm Colony for Epileptic and Feeble-Minded Persons in Gainesville, a state-funded facility that had been established in 1919 to habilitate children with mental deficiencies. Pearl saw the colony as an opportunity to give her son a more independent and productive adult life. Using intelligence quotient testing developed by the French psychologists Alfred Binet and Theodore Simon in 1905, the institution adhered to a classification system for the feeble-minded. Jesse was an imbecile with an IQ in the 25 to 55 range, not as high-functioning as the morons, whose IQs measured in the 55 to 75 range, but capable of being trained to perform repetitive tasks. By 1956, however, the colony had become congested with bedridden idiots, persons with IQs below 25, who had difficulties communicating and were often incontinent. And as their discharge was infrequent, no bed was available for Jesse. Pearl had had to accept that her boy would have to make do with 85-cent hours in the citrus groves and melon patches of Lake County. By the spring of 1957, the Danielses were renting an unpainted, weather-beaten, 4-room wood-frame house that stood on pilings amid a cluster of similar homes on tiny lots along Bay Avenue. with a corrugated metal roof overhanging a short front porch outside and a tin wood-burning stove inside.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?